Just about a picture-perfect summer day, isn't it? Early summer day, looking really good. You heard the man, 75 degrees. Maybe we're going to eke another 10 degrees out of this day before the sun sets on this gorgeous Saturday. Good afternoon, everybody. It is a good afternoon. In fact, let's call it a great afternoon. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you for your company and carry us with you as you go about your business this noon hour. And we hope we can go along for the ride. You heard the weather forecast. Going to get a little wet overnight and into the early morning hours of Sunday, then things are going to clear up. So whatever you've got planned this weekend, I think you can carry it off without too much problem. So here we are. Kyle, you are there. And Kyle, can you believe it? The 4th of July sneaking up on us just, huh? On little cat's feet. What, 1 week from today, huh?
Yeah, it's come quick.
Wow. What do you have planned?
I have to work here.
Yes, you do. I just want to make sure you remember that. I don't think I'm going to be with you, but we'll figure that out a little bit later. But
all right.
Might take the 4th of July off. Well, folks, again, thank you for being with us. We always try to bring you interesting and informative topics here on the Stan Turner Show on Saturdays, and we think today will be no exception owing to our wonderful guest. If I could ask you to think back to last April, just a few months ago, April, you might have heard bells chime one day during the month, not church bells, not on Sunday, but bells, and you weren't quite sure what they meant. Well, we can tell you, remind you maybe, they mark the 150th anniversary of the end of the American Civil War. It was a horrible four-year bloodletting, and in many ways, that Civil War is still not over. You only have to think about the ongoing dispute over the Confederate flag we've been hearing about in recent days, just one dispute among many. One suspects we will be under the shadow of the Civil War for a very long time. It was about this time, 150 years ago, some months after the South's formal surrender, that Minnesota soldiers began returning home. Many mustered out at Fort Snelling and then tried to pick up their lives where they had left off, and it wasn't always easy. Today, on this summer, 150 years after the boys began returning home, we thought we'd revisit that time and this place and find out what it was like. To help guide us on this time traveling, we brought in an authority on the Civil War and Minnesota's place in it. Ken Martins has been with us before and has enlightened us on this subject. And Ken, thanks for coming in this Saturday to shed more light on it. We appreciate it very much.
Hello, Stan. Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, Ken. Before we plunge into the subject today, you have an interesting background. You've spent most of your life here, right?
In Minnesota.
But if we climb up your family tree, I think we'll find some Confederates up there, won't we, huh?
Yeah, Confederates in the attic, as you might say.
Yeah.
I'm three-quarters German. Yeah. And the other quarter is from the South. It's a Southern family, and half of that family has a Confederate history.
Really? Okay. Any notables, any names we might recognize?
Well, in my family, the interesting part is the Cherokee connection. And during the Civil War, they said the Civil War was fought brother against brother. And the Cherokee Nation actually split against itself. Should they fight the federal government that took their land, or should they use the federal government for subsidies they might need after the Civil War? And my Confederate family chose to fight the unconstitutional federal government.
Unconstitutional federal government, you call it. Okay.
The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Cherokee people that they could stay on their land, but then the U.S. Cavalry came and evicted them, and it was now called the notorious Trail of Tears.
Oh, dear. Well, you would certainly then do have a Confederate history in your family, so you must look at this war through the prism of both sides. You must feel some loyalty to the Union side, too, having grown up here.
Yeah, and I've reenacted the Civil War myself, and I have worn a blue uniform, and some Southern family members said, "Your uniform is the right color, isn't it?" Well, they're referring to gray, and I said, "Okay, I have one gray."
You do have one gray in the closet. Okay, keep everybody happy in the family. I want to read something here that kind of sets the stage for this. I mentioned this bloodletting of the American Civil War, and absolute bloodbath it was, to be sure.
It was a horrendous time.
It was. Went from 1861 to 1865. Just listen to this, if you would, please. This is put together, this is part of a book called In Their Own Words, The Civil War as Seen by Washington County, Minnesota Soldiers. Company B of the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Regiment, composed of 101 men from Washington County, was sworn into the Army of the United States on the morning of April 29th, 1861. The regular army on that day counted about 14,600 men. It was this Minnesota regiment, the first regiment to answer Lincoln's call for volunteers to defend the U.S. By May of 1865, okay, the war is now officially over. By May of 1865, 4 years later, over 2.9 million men had enlisted in the Union Army. More than 618,000 of them had died, by best estimates, some on the battlefield, some later of their wounds, and even more of disease. To put this in context, Napoleon's Grande Armée at its greatest had 600,000 soldiers total. 50 Union regiments suffered more than half their men killed or wounded in a single battle, and at least 14 lost more than two-thirds. In the famed Charge of the Light Brigade in the Crimean War, casualties were about 37%. The 1st Minnesota lost around 80% at Gettysburg. None of the men who took the oath that April 1861 could have imagined this. Ken?
It's some of the most fascinating history, and I hope to promote it as an awareness, not to glorify it.
No. One thing about war, you know, warriors gather for reunions, and people sometimes wonder, why do they want to come back and glorify war? That's a misunderstanding of the men and the women who come back. They're not glorifying war. They're celebrating the comradeship and, in many cases, mourning their fellow and sister soldiers who died in the battle.
Boy, you just said so much right there. When the soldiers came home, was there a chance for joy? But there was so much grief that people in Stillwater who had lost their loved ones, their brothers and fathers and sons, they didn't think they would ever escape their grief.
And many of them did not. They carried it with them to their grave.
It identified their life.
It did. I want to read something, and again, I'm not going to make this turn this into a reading fest today, but there are some very fine words put together by some very fine historians. Brian Horrigan is with the Minnesota Historical Society, and Brian wrote this. When members of the 1st Minnesota Regiment returned home in February of 1864, so that meant the Civil War still had more than a year to go, they were greeted with great fanfare. Daniel Bond wrote in his reminiscences about their return to St. Paul, they were welcomed, quote, by the citizens with the most unbounded enthusiasm. All the city seemed insane. So they got a riotous welcome home a year before the war ended in St. Paul. Well, a festive homecoming was not, however, a foregone conclusion. Discharge members of Minnesota's 1st Light Artillery Battery arrived in St. Paul in June of 1865, so the war now officially over, and they felt, quote, somewhat aggrieved that their arrival called forth no demonstrations from our citizens and that women had avoided soldiers as they would mad dogs. Well, at about the same time, it was discovered that about 200 men of the 4th Regiment had already passed unheralded through St. Paul and had dispersed to their homes throughout the state. Embarrassed by these oversights, the city of St. Paul set up a soldiers' home near the levee as a place for disembarking troops to be temporarily fed and housed. A soldiers' reception committee was quickly formed to organize welcoming of events such as testimonial banquets, parades, and triumphal arches throughout the summer of 1865 and into the fall of that year. Now, as the war had wound down to its conclusion, there were no doubt many who, like Minnesota's 7th Regiment Chaplain Elijah Edwards, wondered how the veterans would fare. He asked, "Will a grateful nation take them into remembrance as heroes and saviors of their country?" Well, good question. In some cases, yes. In some cases, as we just heard there, no.
History has recorded Robert E. Lee's surrender on April 9th as the end of the Civil War, which isn't really accurate. The war continued on for another month. the great celebration occurred April 2nd with the news of Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, being captured and surrendering. And that was where the huge celebration took place in Stillwater.
Okay, and this came, of course, days before Appomattox and the so-called formal surrender then.
There was no surrender, but the key moment in their hearts and minds was the loss of the Confederate capital.
Yeah, you brought along a photocopy of the front page of a newspaper from that time. It reads, "Glory, Babylon has fallen." Babylon being the capital of the Confederacy.
Richmond.
Richmond. Richmond is taken. The stronghold of rebellion is ours. General Lee evacuates. Grant has captured 12,000 prisoners and 50 cannon. So reads the headline.
This certainly looks like the end, especially since the rumors of Richmond being captured began in 1862.
In 62?
The news reports were quite erroneous. They were more than hopeful, but it was not the case, not for three more years.
Wow. Well, tell us what happened with the actual fall of Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy. Here in Stillwater, and I'm sure many other places around this state and around the Union at that time, April 2nd, 1865. What was going on in Stillwater, for example?
Well, they gathered for a great celebration for the fall of Richmond, and they brought their anvils down.
Wait a minute, brought their what?
Anvils.
Anvils that you pound, that the blacksmith
used? The blacksmith anvils.
And horseshoes.
They easily weigh 50 pounds apiece, if not 100. And they brought them to Main Street and Myrtle Street on the corner, and they set them up in a row, and they exploded charges below the anvils, launching the anvils sky high like rockets into the air. They lined them up in rows and fired them off in succession. Kaboom, 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 kaboom. They were just wild, shooting anvils into the sky.
And lethal, too, if you got hit by one, huh?
Isn't that the wildest fun you could think of?
Lethal, for sure. This is at the corner of Main Street and Myrtle. That would be right outside the station.
Right out here, where we're sitting.
That's amazing. A whole new meaning to anvil chorus, I guess.
All of this firing was going on by veterans of the 1st Minnesota. And the Company B veterans that were right here from Stillwater were firing these anvils in rapid. These anvils in fire were fired in rapid
succession. Yeah. Look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's an anvil.
Yeah, the veterans had been here for a year, and they were the ones that had taken charge with the big celebration.
All right. So, okay, that's on April the 2nd. Fast forward to April the 9th, 1865. Lee and Grant, on that day, meet at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. They agree to terms of a surrender, which I think took place, the actual surrender, on April the 12th, and then 2 days later, President Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. Is there some quarrel with those dates? Not the assassination, but the actual surrender?
No, the actual surrender, did take place at Appomattox. Mm-hmm. The fighting in the East was done, but it wasn't done in the United States. There was still a great battle going on down in Alabama.
Let's talk about that. We're going to take a break here, Ken Martins. We're talking about the 150th anniversary of the end of the American Civil War. It supposedly officially ended in April of 1865, so 150 years ago, a couple of months ago, but not really. It continued in pockets around parts of the South, right, in the West.
Exactly.
So we'll talk more about that right after this break. Stay with us.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater.
Wolf Beer in the Bottle isn't just another bottled beer. Why? Remove the cork to find out. Yes, that's real cork. Now pour. Taste. The Strong Golden is a Belgian-style ale featuring local honey from the valley, chamomile, and rose hips. Are you ready to enjoy? Go to wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finder. Then ask for Wolf's, Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
The following 20 seconds of Summer Serenity are brought to you by Mosquito Shield.
Burgers are ready.
Mosquito Shield, protecting the serenity of yards everywhere. Get Mosquito Shield now and save $50 on a full season protection plan. Go to MoShield.com and use savings code RADIO.
We are back. Stan Turner with you. Thank you very much. Our guest, Ken Martins, and yours truly, through Ken's expertise on the subject, talking about the 150th anniversary of the end of the American Civil War and Minnesota's place in it, a prominent place to be sure. And Ken, we noted that Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, fell on April the 2nd, 1865, and a few days later, the formal surrender by the South to General Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, and then 2 days later, the death of President Lincoln. And that was a pivot point, in many ways, a pivot point, was it not? The mood of the country, of the Union certainly, and maybe even into the South, changed markedly.
Exactly. And what should have been a happy time was suddenly, with the death of Abraham Lincoln, they're recalling the grief of the loss of their sons and the loss of their brothers and the loss of their fathers. And a grieving mood just swept over the entire country.
And interesting, as you've already pointed out, the guns did not fall silent with the formal surrender of the South. There were pockets of fighting. There were battles still going on for weeks, in fact, months afterwards.
Exactly. And a great battle was being fought at Fort Blakely in Alabama, and many Minnesotans and local soldiers were there at the last great battle of the Civil War.
And when did that take place?
And that took place April 9th, okay. 1865.
All right, just days before the formal surrender.
There had been siege at Spanish Fort, and the Confederates were holding out for a week at the Spanish Fort, and then they evacuated to Fort Blakely, and it was a running battle, siege after siege after siege. It just would not let up. But it wasn't the big news. Robert E. Lee was the big news, yet Minnesotans are there at this great fiasco of one day after another, and the bloodletting wouldn't quit. And finally, the surrender comes at Fort Blakely and the capture of the general Little.
Now, jumping ahead to May, so a month after the formal surrender of the South, we have the Battle of Palmito Ranch in Texas. May 12th and 13th, 1865, won by the Confederates.
The Confederates won the very last battle of the Civil War.
After the surrender.
The cause was lost. Yeah. But isn't it fascinating how the Confederates win the final battle engagement of the Civil War?
Now, is it true that General Lee went ahead with the surrender because he was afraid, almost certain, that Confederates would hold out and continue fighting backbush fights for months, maybe years to come?
And that is a very good concern. And he was a very thoughtful man. Amazingly enough, we have our famous General Grant for winning the Civil War, but General Lee goes down in history and in our nation as one of the most beloved men because he cared about his men. Mm-hmm. It was different than Grant. Grant said, I will use up as many men as I need to win this war. And Lee said, I have to care for these guys and keep them.
Some historians would point out Pickett's charge was maybe the one blot on his record.
That was a bad day,
yeah. That was a bad day for Lee. But basically what you've said is supported by most historians, that he did care about trying to conserve his men and not send them into certain slaughter. So his fear that had he not surrendered, this would have devolved into a guerrilla warfare being fought by Southerners probably was true.
That's a very good point, yes.
Now, the last Confederates, according to your timeline here, the last Confederates surrendered on June 23rd and 24th, 1865, in Indian Territory. Is that right?
That happened 150 years ago this week.
My goodness. That's it. That's right. And again, I keep pointing out, a couple of months after the formal surrender. Is this a case where word didn't get out to some of these pockets around the country?
They were holding out. You know, it's interesting that that's where my great-grandfathers were, the Confederate soldiers, with those Cherokees that held out to the very end. They knew the end was coming, and when they heard the news that Robert E. Lee had surrendered in April, they basically sat in their camps and waited for the Union Army to come out and process the surrender. It took 3 days to process the surrender of nearly 3,000 men. And the last Confederate general came in after the Cherokee soldiers had surrendered. The Cherokee general, Stand Watie, came into the fortification and surrendered himself. The last Confederate general to surrender in the Civil War.
And he was a Cherokee?
He was a Cherokee. Okay. He was the highest-ranking Indian in America.
Ken Martin's Minnesota, about 11 infantry regiments, heavy artillery regiment, a couple of companies of sharpshooters, well-represented in the Eastern campaigns and the Western campaigns, which we'd call the Southern campaigns, I guess, through Tennessee and Mississippi and all of that, right?
So the Atlanta campaign, okay. The Vicksburg campaign.
Talk about some of the battles, famous battles, in which Minnesota played a role.
Well, let's see, which one to start with. You know, what historians in Minnesota don't realize, the significance of the Battle of Antietam, September 17th, 1862. And that battle, the 1st Minnesota was there in a brigade being commanded by their first colonel, Willis Gorman. Willis Gorman had been promoted out of the 1st Minnesota, became a brigadier general, and led a brigade of soldiers, and pushing his own regiment to the front of the battle line at the Battle of Antietam. Now, the Battle of Antietam was America's bloodiest day in history. It was the worst place you could imagine being. And what did General Willis Gorman do? He pushed his old regiment as far as he could, and he achieved the furthest point of advance on America's bloodiest day in history, and the 1st Minnesotans and the Stillwater men were right in the front of that.
Stillwater guys were at sword's point there. Huh?
And
Sam Bloomer,
the premier soldier, the premier hero of Stillwater, Minnesota, was carrying the national colors that day. And he was the one the furthest out in the front when he was shot in the leg. It was a bad moment for Sam Bloomer, our hero from Stillwater.
He lay on the battlefield for a long time, as many of them did, and finally a leg had to be amputated.
He did lose his right leg.
The color bearer, the color sergeant, which he was at Antietam, that was a place, a position of honor, but one of the most perilous places you could be because the enemy was fixing on you, because you were kind of the director of traffic with that flag. If the flag was not just to show the colors, it was a traffic device almost.
That was the focal point, right, of your direction in battle. You had to have a battle flag or the regiment did not know which way it was going.
That's it. So you keyed on the standard bearer there and tried to knock him out.
Exactly.
And Bloomer fell, was not killed. In fact, he survived the war. He was wounded before that engagement at Bull Run, I think, too. He took a shot in the chest.
He had a head wound. They said that, Sam, you got a head wound, and you slept through half the battle.
Yeah, I suppose he would. Amazing guy. We'll talk more about him. He lived to return to Stillwater later. Other campaigns in which Minnesota distinguished itself. Okay, Bull Run for sure, Antietam. Is that also known as Sharpsburg, Antietam?
Sharpsburg, okay, is the Confederate term for the Battle of Antietam.
Other campaigns in which Minnesota...
The Battle of Vicksburg, the 3rd Minnesota was there. Company B of the 3rd Minnesota was formed primarily of Afton, Lakeland, and Stillwater men, Washington County people. And they were involved in a great siege on May 25th, 1863. But the battle fortifications were just so rough. General Grant asked them the impossible to try and climb a great hill and breach the battle lines, and they just could not do it.
What was the loss? Heavy losses, no doubt. Hmm?
Oh, 9,000, I believe, was the casualty rate in a single charge.
Minnesotans also involved in what? Nashville, Shiloh, Corinth,
Chickamauga.
Chickamauga.
The 2nd Minnesota was actually given credit for saving the Battle of Chickamauga, which easily could have been lost. And now I just use the term lost. What historians and people don't realize is how close to losing the Civil War the Union was for those 4 years.
All right. Tell us more about that. That's the intriguing part of this. It was a very close thing, wasn't it?
It was a very close thing, and 1862 was the first big year of the Civil War. Of course, the Union lost the first battle of the Civil War in 1861, the Battle of Bull Run. And they said, you know what, whoever wins the Battle of Bull Run, that's it. We'll decide the direction of the country. But when the Union lost, all that was a different story. Now the war is going to last for years. And all of 1862, the first Minnesota soldiers were in a brigade out east where they were up against the Confederates and then Robert E. Lee on top of that. And with Robert E. Lee's tactics, they just could not outperform Robert E. Lee. Even though Robert E. Lee was outnumbered, he was a much better tactician. And they just could not defeat Lee. They could not capture Richmond. And so the war lasted longer and longer.
It should be noted that Robert E. Lee took his military training at West Point.
At West Point.
Sorry.
Top of his class at West Point.
Which it will be noted that that was a Union school. It turned out to be where many of the Union officers, generals came.
Yeah, you know, the year that the war began, the West Point graduates had to graduate their training in May of 1861 and part ways. And they had to decide which country they were going to fight for.
Right. Oh, some decision for some of them. Easy for some, not so difficult. Not so easy for others. Ken, you've been a reenactor, as you've talked about, and a soldier reenactor. And on these hot summer days, our minds go to the Battle of Gettysburg, fought on, 3 days? July 1, 2, 3, 1863.
Mm-hmm.
Very hot weather. And a decisive, maybe not the decisive, but a decisive battle, certainly in the Civil War.
Gettysburg was such a huge event with nearly 200,000 engaged out there. The scope of it is hard to comprehend. And then to realize as a reenactor, I was out in the battlefield reenacting Gettysburg. And when I saw my first Confederates come through the ravine and appear in a long butternut line of gray, I thought, if they're loaded with real ammunition, we're all dead. And then it struck me that if that was the case, if you're out there and these guys stood in line willing to die, what is that purpose? And is it the cliche cause of slavery? Are you willing to die to set someone in bondage free? Or is it about the nation that the United States experiment in democracy had just failed?
Besides what's going on in your head, what's going on in your body, you can't know for sure. None of us can know unless we were there. But those hot days and these heavy wool uniforms, it must have been a bit of hell on earth just to maintain, stave off dehydration.
I've put on a lot of programs regarding the Civil War, and one of the programs was titled "A Matter of Survival," just trying to survive, not in battle, but living outside for 3 years. When you volunteer for the 4-year war, you volunteer to serve as a soldier for 3 years. Just going outside and living outside for 3 years is a challenge.
Mm-hmm. No kidding. You got to do it for a couple of days and then run home.
Yeah.
4th of July, the 4th. Before we move off Gettysburg, Minnesota's contribution to the Battle of Gettysburg, that 3-day.
Oh, the first Minnesota soldiers that volunteered, and many of them from Stillwater here, were the first volunteers to serve the Union in the Civil War. Officially, that's how it plays out. On July 2nd, the second day of the battle, they are called to plug a hole in the Union lines, and the Confederates are about to punch through. They only have 2 rounds of ammunition left in their cartridge boxes. You know, you carry 40 rounds of ammunition with you, and they have expended almost all of it. And when General Hancock came by looking at the advance of the Confederates upon their position, their weakened position, they're in the center of the battle lines of Gettysburg, and if that gets punched through, the Battle of Gettysburg is going to be over. And after all the defeats that the Union had suffered, it would likely be the end of the Civil War on July 2nd.
There's no doubting the gallantry of Minnesota's 1st Volunteer Infantry Regiment at Gettysburg and in other campaigns, but does that first tend to overshadow the good deeds of Minnesota's other regiments in the Civil War?
Well, like the 2nd Minnesota did save a crucial battle in the south, the Battle of Chickamauga, and Minnesotans aren't remembered very well or well enough as they should be, but it was important that the 2nd Minnesotans were there. They played an important role.
Mm-hmm. All right. And other regiments, they were present and engaged?
The Wisconsin regiments played an important role.
Let's talk
role.
About them for sure. Right, the regiment.
There was an Iron Brigade regiment that included the 2nd Wisconsin Infantry and the 6th Wisconsin Infantry and the 7th Wisconsin Infantry, and they had their glory moments at South Mountain and Antietam, where they held the line as hard as they could, and they took nothing but casualties. Mm-hmm. And so they gave so much of their strength in preservation of the Union, and that's what the war was being fought over, the preservation of the Union.
Mm-hmm. Back to Gettysburg and the Minnesotans, a guy named Marshall Sherman. Can you give us a... the story about Marshall Sherman?
Well, Marshall Sherman was a private from St. Paul, and he was in line at Gettysburg, and he had survived the charge of July 2, the crucial charge that preserved, that General Hancock used the 1st Minnesota to preserve the battle line that day at the 80% casualty rate, which was a terrible day. The next day, they thought they put the 1st Minnesota in a safer position where they wouldn't suffer so many casualties because there was only about 115 guys left to stand in line. And Marshal Sherman was there when the Great Pickett's Charge occurred, and the 28th Virginia, I'm going to say this time. The 14th Virginia did something significant in that charge, but what happened with the 28th Virginia is they made it all the way up to the front of the Minnesota soldiers. They faced off with each other. Bayonets were fixed. Marshal Sherman ran up to the color bearer of the 28th Virginia with his Confederate flag and said, "Hand over that battle flag or I'll run you through." And that bayonet is very intimidating, and you will surrender to a bayonet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Marshal Sherman captures a flag. He wins the Medal of Honor for capturing the flag. It's the most important thing that you can do mm-hmm. in a Civil War battle.
And Ken Martins, where is that Virginia, the 28th Virginia battle
flag
today?
Well, that's in Minnesota.
That's where?
It's still in Minnesota.
Yes. Over the protests, I might say, loud protests, the persistent protests.
I understand the cost of life to capture the flag was so incredibly great mm-hmm. that Minnesotans don't want to give it up, mm-hmm. even though there's a federal law that says they're supposed to return all the mm-hmm. Confederate flags to where they came from.
How do you feel about it?
Personally, I say it should go back to the owners.
Mm-hmm.
The owners would put it on display, on a permanent display, and tell the story of its history. And the story of its history is very important. Mm-hmm. Minnesota Historical Society keeps it in preservation as best that they can. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't tell the story of the men that lost their lives to capture it.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it on display at the Minnesota Historical Society. They do bring it out from time to time. They bring it out of the dark, dark cave there where they keep it away from light, which is understandable. And they do tell the story, but it's not out there every day. That's right.
You can ask permission to see it. They'll offer it to you. But it really should be, in my opinion, a permanent display, a permanent part of Minnesota history. And if they can't do that, it would become a permanent part of Virginia history.
Okay. That's your prescription, if you could have your way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Ken Martins, we're going to take another breather here. We'll be right back with Ken Martins, the 150th anniversary of the end of America's bloodiest war, the American Civil War. We'll be back after this.
Timeless tastes and timeless ingredients are why people ask for Wolf's. So which Wolf's will you ask for? The Strong Golden Belgian Style Ale is light-bodied, yet seductively strong warmer. Maybe it's the Berlin-style Weiss, the sour wheat ale that's dubbed the Champagne of the North. Or perhaps it's the German-style ale, Weizenbach, the dark wheat ale brewed to Bach strength. Whichever, make sure you ask for Wolf's. Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
The beauty and ambiance of historic Stillwater is on full display all year long in an open-air tour with Stillwater Trolley. Make plans today to be a part of the brewery and winery tour with Stillwater Trolley every Sunday all summer long. You'll visit Liftbridge Brewery, St. Croix Winery, and the famous Freight House. The Stillwater Trolley's Brewery and Winery Tour. For tickets and information, visit stillwatertrolley.com or call 651-430-0352. That's 651-430-0352.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater. And we continue here with our friend Ken Martins, an authority on the American Civil War and Minnesota's place in it. And Ken's family has a place in it. Kind of ironic, interesting, isn't it, Ken, that you're kind of, with your family connections and all the rest, it's kind of a story of the first and the last, isn't it? Why don't you explain that?
Well, here we are in Minnesota, and I spent most of my life in Minnesota, and the place where the first volunteers originated to preserve the Union, the reason, which is the reason that the war was fought, and being so closely associated to the cause of preserving the Union. And then as a teenager growing up in a home in Lakeland where the sons all volunteered, six of the sons volunteered to go off to Civil War. And as a kid, I was always curious, what was that like to have all those brothers go off to Civil War, six of them, and five of them come home alive? And my own personal history with the Confederacy, my mind was open to both sides of the story. And then at the end of the Civil War, discovering that my family were the last Confederates to surrender. It's the full scope of of emotional range that you experience.
If you have an identity crisis, I can understand it. An inner conflict, to be sure, maybe. Well, the assassination of President Lincoln in April of 1865, did it mute the 4th of July celebrations across the Union in that year?
Lincoln's assassination really changed the mood of the country. And as you mentioned in the beginning of the program, how after the assassination, the soldiers that returned home were disrespected, that no one wanted to cheer. Nobody had a cheer in it, in them. And so soldiers came home with no parade, no party. The mood had gone completely drained out of the nation.
Was it a nation, the Union, a war weariness that caused this? They certainly weren't. Were they really disrespecting the soldiers who had done the fighting, the bleeding and the dying? I mean, as I mentioned, a year earlier, they were getting what, you know, today would be called ticker tape parades.
The celebration had taken place, and there was no mood to celebrate. The veterans were deeply respected from then on. Veterans organizations and even women formed organizations to support the veterans. And so there was all this respect for the veterans who had served in the Civil War. It's unfortunate that the returning soldiers didn't get their celebrations.
Yes. Tell us about the 4th of July celebrations, including the one right here in Stillwater in 1865. The war is now over.
Now, the war is over. The one thing that had happened the week prior to the 4th of July, this week, June 30th, I believe, they sentenced the conspirators in the Lincoln assassination. And they had been sentenced to hung. And that was a huge relief to get that trial under their belt and behind them. And so now they could plan for the 4th of July. They could plan for the 4th of July fireworks that would be launched off the roof of the Holcomb Block on the corner of Chestnut and Main Street. And they were going to read the Declaration of Independence, and they were back to a united country, which is what the war was about. And so they were going to celebrate the United States as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And they did just that.
Hmm? And they did.
Okay. Want to ask you about a couple of these battle wounded soldiers who have, in the ensuing years, have gained some notoriety. Colonel William Colville is one of them. You go to the state capitol and it's not being torn apart for renovation, and one of the big statues you see in the rotunda is one of Colonel William Colville. Tell us a bit about him and what he endured on the battlefield.
Well, he had been promoted to colonel of the regiment for Chancellorsville and Gettysburg. And
which regiment was that?
The first Minnesota.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of the first Minnesota. And at Gettysburg, he ordered the men to fix their bayonets for the charge that Governor Hancock had issued. And that's a pretty scary moment when you're ordered to fix bayonets. Then you know the Civil War is suddenly, it's not going to be at a distance, it's going to be in the face of the enemy, it's going to be personal.
Did you mean General Hancock, not Governor?
General Hancock,
right.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So during that charge, as they ran 300 yards from their original position headlong into the Confederates, they are losing men left and right. The Confederates are firing into the ranks of a running horde of Minnesotans who are bound and determined to save the Union, that the Confederates will not punch through this line, that these Minnesotans were just pioneers. They just started the new state of Minnesota. Minnesota had only existed as a state for 3 years. And if they are going to lose the Civil War, it's not going to be because of Minnesota. And so many men had been shot down the first 150 yards of that charge that Colville had the thought to halt the men. He called the men to a halt. He said, dress the line, which means fill the gaps, tighten it up, and he ordered a charge for the second time in the middle of the battlefield. And that's when they ran down into the face of the Confederates and confronted them.
It was standard operating procedure for the colonel to stand behind his men so he could get an overview of the battle and the oncoming enemy, right?
Yeah,
so
I believe
Colville
he was
standing there and fully exposed to the shot, to the shelling and all the rest of it.
And he went with the men.
He did. And he took at least three hits, didn't he?
And, you know, his ankle and foot wounds were the most debilitating.
And it crippled him for the rest of his life.
He had to walk with a brace.
To his left or right, there was a Major Mark Downey, a lad born in Ireland who came from the Stillwater area here. And he, too, was fully exposed to the shell firing and all the rest of it. And he, too, went down wounded, did he not?
Yeah, the officers were going down, and actually it was Sinclair of the 1st Minnesota that took a ball to the chest, or what they called a round ball, which flattened itself on his breastbone. And that's an amazing feat, to have a bullet flattened on your breastbone. It's a very painful thing to stop a round like that. Fortunately, those kind of projectiles may have taken a bounce in the dirt and come back up to strike him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this terrible bruising effect that the bruise itself could have been fatal.
These guys who survived, they were the walking wounded for the rest of their lives, weren't they? I mentioned Major Mark Downey. One of the shells, or one of the bullets, shattered his arm. It was useless for the rest of his life. And he still tried to help people. In fact, he settled in Florida in the South in his later years. He only lived to the age of 43 because his life was foreshortened by his injuries. And his exertions to help other people, these were amazing folks.
The soldiers lived their lives, and yet their death was caused by their Civil War wounds many years later.
Tell us about the ladies who sometimes accompanied the soldiers to the battles and tried to help out. Amazing subtext to the story here.
There's a French term, vivandier, and ladies were wearing pantaloons with the skirt over, And a lot of people, guys back then, disagreed with ladies in pantaloons and shortened skirts. But they were out as some of the first persons you would see if you were wounded. Vivandiers were kind of like a traveling nurse. They were water carriers, and yes, there was dehydration and people dying of heat exhaustion. And so they carried the pretty big canteen. They could fill a lot of canteens from theirs.
Mm-hmm. And they were there. They were in the battle zone, too, weren't they, the ladies?
And they were. They weren't really combatants. They were armed with a pistol. And if they needed it for their own personal protection, they would use it. But they were quite a unique sight to see on the battlefield.
I don't think that's fully known, is it? A lot of people don't realize the ladies were out there.
They were documented. I believe reenactors are now taking it as a passion to count Vivandiers. And then last I heard, there was 200 Vivandiers accounted for in the Civil War.
Back to Brian Horrigan of the Minnesota Historical Society. He talks about the years after the end of the Civil War, about the soldiers. He writes, as the young soldiers of the 1860s began to enter middle age, many of them dug out letters and diaries and produced memoirs of what had surely been the most powerful years of their lives. He writes, the time, it seemed, had come to share their memories with a wider public, to participate in the creation of a national collective memory. The period 1880 to 1915 was the high watermark of the Civil War memoir, and was also the era that produced a bounty of regimental histories and publication efforts such as the Minnesota in the Civil War and Indian Wars, and also last men's clubs, too, veterans of the war who would gather to celebrate each other and the fact they had come through. Tell us about this,
please. Well, the Civil War was the defining moment of these men's lives, and it became an enduring memory for them, and everything they did, they were obsessed with Civil War. They were obsessed with collecting the memorabilia. They were obsessed with writing their words down, and they were obsessed with saving the letters they got during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And the last men's clubs, there was one for the Civil War veterans. Of course, they're long, long gone, as there were for World War One and World War Two. Some of the guys are still around. But the Civil War, would they have a bottle of cognac that they would, during their meetings, and it would be held in seal for the last guy standing?
Yeah, the last man standing was going to be able to drink from this fabulous bottle of wine, and they glorified this like it would be a wonderful thing to be the last man surviving of this Civil War event. And the group got smaller and smaller over the years, from the 1880s when it was formed until 1932, when Charles Lockwood was the last Minnesota soldier of Company B Stillwater to sit at the table of empty chairs.
Oh wow. Did he drink the wine?
He did, but he didn't like it. He said it was had spoiled in the vinegar. They say that it was supposed to be stored on its side and it had been left standing upright. It was just drinking terrible vinegar.
A bitter taste for the last
man. It was a terrible bottle. It's the worst thing he ever drank in his life. And then he said, this is the worst club ever invented.
Oh, my goodness sakes. Whoa. That's going out with a shot, isn't it? We've got to mention this, too. Although he was not a Minnesotan, General George Custer passed through this region on his way to Little Bighorn, didn't he, in 1876.
Yeah, the cavalry engagement of the U.S. against the Lakota and Cheyenne people of the Indian Wars. The event took place on the anniversary of June 25th. The battle was in 1876. Custer and his cavalry. Custer was a Civil War hero of incredible magnitude. He had led 60 charges on cavalry horseback in the Civil War, survived them all. He outlived his horses in the Civil War. He outlived his horses in the Civil War.
Wow.
And as a cavalry general, he should have been standing in a position of safety commanding his men, but no, he led the men. The casualty rate was incredibly high, but the success rate was important. When the Union was losing the war, Custer was winning the battles. But now out at the Little Bighorn in the Montana area of Dakota Territory, Custer had met his match. He'd entered into an Indian camp where he was far outnumbered. There was more warriors than he had bullets in his command, and so he met his demise at the age of 36.
Crazy Horse was his nemesis. Hmm.
And Crazy Horse was a great warrior, and he was also a great tactician. And he had observed cavalry tactics the week before at the Battle of Rosebud Creek and used those cavalry tactics against Custer, and Custer's command was eliminated. The 212 men of Custer's command were eliminated in about a half an hour.
Hmm. You've been out there. What did Crazy Horse do to outflank him or to surprise him and vanquish him?
Crazy Horse realized that cavalry likes to fight from hilltops, and Crazy Horse knew from their campground at the Little Bighorn River where the hilltops were, and as the cavalry approached, he knew which way they would climb the hill, so he did a giant end around the hillside and came up the backside of the hill right into the face of the cavalry. The cavalry was not prepared for this, and being outnumbered as they were taken out by the Lakota Sioux pretty rapidly.
So what's the bottom line on General Custer? Is he revered as a great leader of men or as a vainglorious guy who was out to plump up his own reputation?
It appears from his military career that he disobeyed many orders during the Civil War. As a result of his disobedience and his ADHD tactics, he was victorious. Well, they couldn't fault him for being victorious, even though they wanted to court-martial him for disobedience. He did the same thing, disobeying orders out at the Little Bighorn. This time, he was up against far more numbers than he could deal with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, getting back to Minnesota and the Civil War, Ken, to sum up Minnesota and its contributions, its troops and all the rest, if you could tie it up in a neat little package, what would you say?
Well, Minnesota was, it's interesting how the pioneer spirit, Minnesota just being formed and being 3 years old,
They're fully involved and engaged as Americans, even though they came from...
They were going to lose their state. That's what I want to say is they were going to lose their state. We just formed the state, and now you tell us the United States is over. And we're putting our foot down, and it's a cause willing to die for.
And they did. And history will say that they did an extraordinary job
on the battlefield. And they should be remembered better than they are, you're right.
Okay. Ken, you've got a book before we run here. Tell us about the book you have authored.
I wrote a book about the St. Croix River Valley. It's called The Perilous St. Croix River Valley Frontier. It's an adventure history. It's engaging, mm-hmm. and it makes history interesting. I make a lot of sense out of confusing issues.
Good for you. Thank you.
I've included a lot of the Indian battles of the St. Croix Riverway when it was in dispute between Dakota and Ojibwa. There's a chronological order of the battle engagements, and it makes sense of something you never knew about.
And we thank you for that. The Perilous St. Croix River Valley Frontier by Ken Martens, M-A-R-T-E-N-S. You can get it at a local bookseller here. Kenny, thank you so much. Have a great summer, my friend.
Thank you, Stan.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Enjoy the weather. It's a beaut out there. We'll see you for the All Request and Dedication program Monday, right after the news at noon. Bye-bye.